Hello everyone and welcome back to Sensational, the Special Educational Needs Podcast. My name is Molly, Marketing and Events Officer from Withersat Group, and I'm delighted to be joined today by our friend Helen Rutherford, Specialist Sleep Practitioner from the Sleep Charity, who has over 40 years of experience working to support neurodiverse children and young people navigating the challenges of sleep. So Helen, welcome to your first podcast with us.
Thank you.
If you'd like to start by telling us a little bit more about who you are and your work.
I will do. So I think most importantly, I'm going to tell you I'm a mum to four children. They are grown up now. My youngest is 17, but I do think it helps when you actually know what it feels like to be sleep deprived in order to be able to talk to people about it. As you said, I've worked with children with significant additional needs for nearly 40 years now. I ran our portage service in the north of Worcestershire for 12 years. I've been family liaison officer for a special school for 3 years. I've always worked in family support units and assessment units. I joined the Sleep Charity in 2016, but I've been with them for the last few years full time as their lead practitioner. And my role as lead practitioner involves running some of the clinics that we're commissioned to do. I travel the country training parents and professionals. I take part and run some of the training webinars that we provide. I give clinical supervision to our sleep practitioner delegates, and I run some of the live Q&As for the sleep practitioner training as well. So quite a diverse role within the charity.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you, Helen. And let's start the podcast with a question I think we all need to know the answer to. So why is sleep so important?
There isn't one aspect of our lives that isn't affected by sleep. If you just think about yourself and me, if you just have one or maybe two nights of really rubbish sleep, you can see your mood lower. You might feel more emotional. You might feel sluggish. And we're so much less tolerant and we forget things. Now imagine then how parents feel when this has been going on for months, and for those that come to us sometimes for years. Can you imagine how awful that's going to feel? So what's going on in the background? Well, it affects our immune system, so we can find ourselves picking up more illnesses, and if we get injured, we actually take longer to repair. When we sleep, lots of our hormones are released. So very often we can see hormonal imbalances, and that goes for children as well. Just one example is the growth hormone is one of the hormones that's released when we sleep. And for children who are chronically sleep deprived, we might see shorter stature. But once sleep is sorted, then this hormone is free to sort of go and do its own thing again. Long term, it's really quite serious. It can affect the heart. It can put people at risk of strokes. There's a very high correlation of obesity and sleep deprivation. We can have blood pressure issues. It can affect kidney functions. There's also some links between certain types of dementia due to the brain not having the opportunity to flush toxins away during sleep. It can lead to low mood and depression. It's really not unusual for me to meet parents who've been prescribed antidepressants because the symptoms of being sleep deprived mimic those of depression. Wow. Daily life becomes really hard because you're just so exhausted. Self-care becomes less of a priority. Think about our teens as well. They're very often impulsive enough, but when you add chronic sleep deprivation into the mix, we can see adrenaline boosting behaviours, risk taking behaviours, and there's also a high chance that they'll filter into sort of substance abuse. We have lack of self-regulation, that low mood and that vicious cycle of no end in sight. We see lots of couples separating. One sign of sleep deprivation is hyperactivity. Imagine trying to put that overtired toddler to bed. This is what sleep deprivation can often look like. We see a lot of children being assessed for ADHD due to that hyperactivity state. They're going to have that inability to focus, you know, when you're drifting off, if you're daydreaming, or you just read the same part of a book time and time again, you just don't have that ability to focus on what you're doing and retain information.
Yeah.
You might be, again, because of that inability to self-regulate, you might see more aggression in your children. You might see that they're getting more into fights more, they're arguing with teachers more, detention levels go up. I've also seen parents more often than not having to either take a sidestep in the job that they're doing or leave jobs completely because they're just not able to cope with the demands of the pressure of the work, or they're constantly being called into school because the children are either falling asleep or they've got into trouble or they're ill again. And it's just a really complex cycle that really doesn't break. Migraines, parents often say, you know, I've always got a headache, I get migraines a lot, I feel really sick, I'm dizzy all the time. And on top of that, you see minor injury units probably are really full of people who are sleep deprived because we're clumsy, and household accidents rise in this group of people.
Right, wow, it's such a massive topic, isn't it? So many different things linked to it.
Yeah, like I said, there is nothing that's not covered by better sleep. It affects everything. And when we talk to children, it's all right telling, you know, you can tell them, oh, it's good for your immune system, it's good for your it's good for your memory. But actually that doesn't resonate with a lot of children.
Yeah.
So we have to twist it and say, okay, if you're really good at sports, it's great for reflexes. Or if you are academic, it's great for putting things into long-term memory. Or if they're gamers, again, you'll think more quickly, you'll be able to react better. So you just, you know, you can put it into every single aspect of life.
Yeah. And if we think more specifically about our children and young people, what would you say are some of the most common sleep challenges experienced by children with SEN, and how do they differ from neurotypical children?
I think all the common sleep issues are the same, but then I think there are additional sleep issues as well. So I don't think they have different ones, but they also have exactly the same ones. So let's just cover the basic ones first. Typical ones are, when they're little, is fears. So fear of the dark and fears of monsters being under the bed. Please do not spray for monsters under your bed. You're just validating that they may be there. Going to sleep too late, really, really common one. Waking throughout the night. So parents might say, actually, going to sleep isn't a problem, but they don't stay asleep throughout the night. Some of them might just find it really hard to settle. It takes them hours to settle. Others, especially children with SEN, this is a really common one, is that they just wake really early. So they may have had enough sleep to function, even though it's not enough sleep for them to need to be fully rested. Napping at inappropriate times. And again, switching it back to our SEN children, they often get bussed into work. Bussed into school. So they could spend an hour on that minibus in the morning and in the evening, and this is prime time for having those inappropriate naps. So they're not going to be sleepy at bedtime. So that isn't just a sleep issue, it's part of a lifestyle issue, and we have to work pastorally with schools to try and find ways of keeping them awake on the way home. And that's really tricky sometimes, because sometimes that is really out of our control. Nightmares and night terrors, this is, you know, really, really common. It happens to all children. They're two separate things. Nightmares happen in the lighter, that REM phase of sleep, that dream phase. Night terrors are what we call parasomnias, and they happen in the first few hours of sleep, in that really deep phase of sleep. If you think about 40% of neurotypical children will have a sleep issue at any one time, that's quite a high number. But when you think about SEN, that number goes up to 80 to 90%. So why is that figure double? That's the question, isn't it? So everything we've talked about happens to all children. But when we start to dig into the SEN, a lot of the issues tend to be sensory. So if your child's got a sensory need that you're addressing in the day, then we absolutely have to deal with those at night as well. So they might have difficulties blocking out environmental sounds. They might have fizzy brains that just won't switch off. They might have proprioceptive needs that make them feel unsafe, like they're floating or falling. You might have those heightened smell sensitivities. They might find the bedclothes irritating. They might be sensitive to light. On top of all of that, they're almost nearly all are susceptible to primary sleep disorders. So children with ADHD, for example, are 25% more likely to have a primary sleep disorder. And that's really significant. And these are things like apneas, where you struggle to breathe or you gasp for air. Movement disorders, so rhythmic movement, periodic limb movement, restless leg syndrome, bruxism, which is teeth grinding. And on top of that, there's also some syndromes where we know that the brainwave activity is different, so they don't get the right amount or the same amount of deep brain sleep. So Smith-Magenis syndrome, Williams syndrome, for example, these children really susceptible due to their brainwave activity. And that's not a behavioural activity, that's a medical need. Yeah. So this is the reason why that figure goes up to sort of 80-90%. It's really unusual to find a child with some sort of SEN who hasn't got some sort of sleep problem.
Yeah. Something I found really interesting is, obviously, we've worked with you on a number of events now, and
we're getting really pally, aren't we?
Aren't we? If we go back to the proprioceptive needs, and something really interesting I found you said about, did you work with a family and they couldn't quite work out what the problem was with the child, but you soon realised it was because they preferred, were they sleeping on the floor?
That was my child.
Oh, was it your child?
It was mine, yeah.
Oh, what was that?
I mean, he went through mainstream, but I did fill out like 3 pages of A4 paper, and I took it to our consultant, and I worked with this consultant every day through my working life when I was in that role. And he looked at me and he went, "Oh, Helen, hi." And I went, "Hi, finish your cup of tea, sit down and listen to me, and then tell me to go home." And I read through this page and page and page of information I had on my child. And it was all, you know, because I knew what I was doing, I could put something in place. So his behaviour was difficult, so I put behaviour programmes in. He couldn't cope with changes, so you know we put strategies in place. But one of the things was he was really clumsy. He could run like the wind, but if you put a piece of string across the ground, he would trip over it. if someone said, "Oh, your son's up the tree," I'd think, "Oh, please don't be Josh, please don't be Josh," because I knew he could climb up. There's not a chance he could get down again.
Yeah.
But he was the one who used to sleep under the bed, and I never knew why it was. I thought it was just because he liked to be in a little den. So it was he shared with his brother, and it was a little push and out bed. So when put them to bed, the one bed came out and it made a little den. And every time I went to check on him, he was asleep under there. But it didn't matter. I didn't care. He was quite comfy, and I just thought, "Oh, that's quite cute." But it was when we went camping and we had those air mattresses and we blew them up, and husband and I were rolled together in the middle in the morning, and he was still on his and it was fully inflated. And we said, "Oh, can we swap? And then yours isn't leaking, so at least we might get one night. This isn't leaking properly, but you're lighter. There's two of us, and you know, it probably won't have deflated by the time you wake up in the morning." And this was my light bulb moment. It's when he said, "Don't mind having the mattress, Mum, but could you please take all the air out of it?" And that was when I thought, "Oh, it's the hard ground he needs. It's proprioceptive feedback that he was seeking." So his mattress was too soft for him. Did I ever ask him, "Is your mattress okay?" Of course I didn't. It's not the kind of thing you ask your children. You just assume the bed's comfy. But he just said no. And when we camped, he would sleep through breakfast. He'd still be there. He'd wake up while we were preparing lunch. He loved camping. And it was because the ground was so hard. So it's about tuning in. Sometimes you have to be a really good detective to find out what the problems are.
Yeah, because I would have never, until I met you and spoke about these things, I'd have never had a clue that like that was even a thing.
I know. And until you wear the badge, you don't realise, do you? It's like watching Millionaire, isn't it? You know the answer, it's really easy, but if you don't know it, you're never going to be able to get to the bottom of that one. You'll never be a millionaire.
No. So brilliant. So what would you say? I think we've kind of touched on bedtimes and routines a little bit there, but what are your top tips and strategies that parents can implement to establish a consistent and supporting bedtime routine?
There's so much you can do. And I think you also have to remember that not every child will need everything. So it's a case of getting out there, learning as much as you can and taking the bits that work for you and that your child needs. But experimentation again, they might need something or they might not. But how do you know until you've tried it? And they might need a combination of things. But establishing a good routine is the first thing, keeping the timings consistent. Now, if your child isn't sleeping until later, you have to start a bit later initially. But as you start to sort sleep out, then you can start to bring that time backwards. So it becomes a little bit more age appropriate. Having a regular wake up time as well, that often gets forgotten, even at the weekends. If you let your children sleep in at the weekends because their sleep's rubbish during the week, all you're doing is eating into the sleep drive of the night to come. Yeah. So make sure even at the weekends we're getting them up and not allowing them to have those inappropriate naps. Focusing on that hour before sleep. Now, remember, that might not be bedtime initially. You might think they should be in bed by 8, but actually they're not asleep till 11. So we're looking at starting at 10. So just initially focusing on that hour before sleep and make it really relaxing. So removing screens to reduce that overstimulation, lowering the lights in your lounge so that we can start to make melatonin, do some calming or sensory activities, again, depending on the needs and abilities of your children, to lower those fizzy brains. A lot of children say to us, oh, I can't drop off because my brain's too fizzy. It's a word that they use really often. It's a great description, isn't it?
Yeah.
Listen to some relaxing music, so instrumental, low wave, ideally delta wave is really good. While you're doing those activities, having a little snack, the right kind of foods. I think I'm going to mention foods a bit later on, actually.
Yeah.
Because it's really quite useful. Have a nice warm bath. Again, if that's okay for your child, it's pointless putting a bath in if it causes sensory irritation. So you'll just undo the whole work of that hour by putting them in a bath if they hate it. The same as hair washing or teeth brushing. If they hate it or it causes anxiety, take it out of the routine. However, if it's okay, pop it in sort of half an hour before you're going to go to bed. We want to raise the body temperature so that as they come out of it and that body temperature starts to gradually lower, again, on its own, it will do nothing, but as part of a big routine, it can help. So a bath about half an hour before sleep. 10 to 15 minutes of either them reading to themselves if they're older, or you reading to them, or a massage, or singing songs, or stroking hair, just to reinforce that bedtime's a really positive time, that there's no punishment to going to bed.
Yeah.
Make sure that environment is consistent as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, because when you said about teeth brushing, I understand like the sensory issues that can come with that. So at what point would you say to brush the teeth? Because you feel like that naturally would come at night time. Yeah. How would that work?
Yeah, and it should do. So there's a few things you can do. You can either use a bristleless brush, so something maybe with silicone heads. You could use a flavourless toothpaste.
Yeah.
Or if it's the actual sensation of it and they can't stand anything in the mouth, then do it before that hour before bedtime.
Right, okay. Before they settle down.
Yeah, and it's all about association. So linking heightened anxiety with going to bed is not going to put them into the right frame of mind to get into bed.
Yeah.
So if you do it all before that wind down, everything within that wind down is going to be positive, including the fact that I don't have to clean my teeth anymore because I did that ages ago.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But going back to the environment, making sure that the lighting is the same, the sounds are the same. So again, it's not always very obvious, but if your child wakes multiple times throughout the night, think about how you settled them. So if you lie down with them and then you get up to go to your own bed, when they wake, and our children wake multiple times a night, they're called partial wakenings. If nothing has changed, they're likely to transition into the next sleep phase. If there's anything different, the brain's going to say, "Oh, something's different. We come from caveman times. Let's just wake you up to assess whether that difference is a threat or not." And all our children know is that they're awake. Now, if they need that parent to come back into them, we have what we call an association. And it could be anything. It could be that they've had a bottle to go to sleep if they're little. It could be that you put a starlight show on, and that's on a timer. They listen to an audio tape, and that's on a timer. You've left the landing light on and you turn it off when you come to bed. So just thinking about how they're falling asleep, making sure that's maintained all night, and that's very likely to lower some of those wakings throughout the night. But remember, any changes can take a couple of weeks before you start to see them making a difference. So don't try it for a few nights and think, "Oh, that's not working." You have to work through transitions. A lot of our children have nighttime interventions needed, so medication, repositioning, nappy changes, you know, making sure that we do those with a minimal interaction. Don't turn the lights on, don't take them out of the bedroom, try not to engage as much as you can, just so that night and day look very different. And how do they know it's time to get up in the morning? It can be light in the summer, it can be dark in the winter. So is it morning? Is it not morning? I feel like I've had enough sleep. So shall I get up? Oh, who cares if it's only 3 o'clock? I feel okay.
Yeah.
So making sure that night and day are different. So yeah. Lights on a timer, a radio on a timer. So when that goes off, they know they're allowed to get up. And again, that's teaching by association. Radio's off, sleep time. Lights are off, sleep time. And when those fairy lights on a timer come on at, we say 6 o'clock is a cutoff. No one wants to wake up at 4.
No.
Then we know they're allowed to get up. So yeah. That when they wake and it's still dark or quiet, they understand that it means that's still nighttime. And that, again, means they're more likely to transition into the next sleep cycle. If you look at research, what you find is children who get up really early consistently do so because they're allowed to.
Right.
Now, I say that without being condescending. They're allowed to because we have to keep them quiet because everybody else needs to get to sleep. You know, the siblings have got school, dad's got work, mum's got work. So we have to keep them as quiet as possible. And very often that means taking them downstairs so that nobody else is disturbed. But it served a purpose. I'm awake, therefore I make some noise. I can go downstairs and play with my toys. So it's about retraining that behaviour. And that takes time.
Yeah. So how would, with that, funny enough, my colleague were talking just before I came to do this podcast, and she said, please ask how I help my daughter from getting up so early, which is obviously what you've just saying. But how do you do that with the training then? How would you?
There's lots of things you can do. It's about maintaining that environment. So making sure that you've got blackout blinds at your windows, but also that the light isn't going to come in through the sides. So do you have to put something? So I always say to parents, get some double-sided Velcro, stick it to the frame of your window and get a piece of Teflon fabric. And so it's right against the frame. Still use your blackout blind. But you can take it off because it's Velcro. You can take it off and fold it away by day and it doesn't interfere. But it means you're controlling that internal light environment. It means doing strategies like rapid return or gradual retreat. So if they get up, you take them back to bed. And you might be doing it for an hour or so until they finally drop back off again. But you have to be consistent and do it over time. So keep taking them back. Keep either sitting next to them or wait outside the door. The minute they get up, you take them back. Shh, sleep time.
Yeah.
and just keep going. So over time, they realise that actually they're not going to be allowed to get up anymore, and we can extend that sleep because they do need. It's a very sort of slow, small percentage of children who don't need their average sleep needs. They're just not getting it because they're so wired and they're ready to go. But you know, even the tiniest light can. So we're talking like an LED light off a TV or a smoke. Mind the smoke alarm in my bedroom, and I only think about it when I'm talking about it, like now, or when I wake up and it's like a beacon. Because when I first turn the lights off, the contrast is big enough for me not to notice it. However, when I wake up, it's like a spotlight.
Yeah.
And I don't think to do anything until I'm lying in bed and I'm too tired then, so I don't. And then I forget about it. And then I talk about it and think I really should do something about my sleep.
Yeah.
But that can lower melatonin on a light sensitive child. So we need to make sure that there's no unknown lights getting through. So put a piece of blue tack on any LED lights that you might have. Make sure things like environmental sounds are covered. So a dimmer switch has a buzz throughout it. So if you turn your lights really low, that might buzz. So a child who is quite sound sensitive may wake up through environmental sounds in the second half of the night. Yeah, being consistent, taking them back, making sure night and day are very different, making sure they're not allowed to lie in. And it's time and consistency that win the game.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. And also, I know we spoke about this a little bit earlier, but are there any dietary or nutritional considerations that might be detrimental to sleep?
Yeah, what we eat in the day can affect our sleep. So highly processed foods, they're not great for promoting sleep. So try and limit sugar in foods, especially from dinner time onwards, because these are one of the reasons our children have fizzy brains. It just gives the brain a boost and it takes a long time for that to be processed. Having meals with high fat content, for example, again, can take longer to process. So having an evening meal that's easier to digest, so chicken rather than chicken nuggets, potato rather than chips, that sort of thing. It's the high processed food that our body has trouble digesting.
Yeah.
Eating your main meal really close to bedtime, again, you need to give your body some time to digest that.
Yeah.
Thinking about caffeine, I know it sounds daft when we talk about caffeine and children, but teenage children, you can imagine in my house, energy drinks are next to rat poison on the shelf. They're really, really bad. They're definitely not allowed to be ingested. However, when they have their own money and they have friends who look a bit older than them, it's quite easy to get hold of them. So just making sure you know that your teens aren't having those monster energy drinks because they are really high in caffeine. But also, although we don't naturally give our children caffeine, it's knowing where it's hidden. So Diet Coke, for example, that might not have sugar in it, but it's really high in caffeine.
Yeah, I only learned that the other day. Yeah.
Green tea, we see it as a healthy drink, but actually it's really high in caffeine. Giving your child a hot chocolate before bedtime sounds like the most natural, relaxing thing to do, but it's a caffeine and a sugar boost.
I didn't know there was caffeine in hot chocolate. Yeah,
it's chocolate. There's caffeine in chocolate,
Of course.
You and I might be able to eat a whole Cadbury's bar of chocolate and be fine, but if you're caffeine sensitive, it's definitely going to make a difference. And children are more caffeine sensitive because their bodies haven't developed tolerance to it yet.
Yeah.
And caffeine has up to a 6-hour half-life, so whatever you had at dinner, so if you have a cup of coffee at dinner time, half of that's still in your system 6 hours later.
My God.
So, it's really worth thinking about.
I think I'm quite sensitive to caffeine because my partner can have a cup of tea before bed and I just look at him like, I do not know how you're drinking that, because I would be up all night from a cup of tea.
And not everyone realises tea has caffeine in it, but it's very slightly lower, but it's more or less the same as coffee. But there are things that you can have. I'm telling you what not to have. Let's tell you what you can have.
Yeah.
So just having a little snack at bedtime. Sometimes our younger children, they might have a dinner at a nursery, and very often that is a snacky tea, and they might go to bed and it's too long. This is another reason for morning wake-ups very often. It can be too long for little tummies to stay asleep till 7 o'clock the next morning. But also you get those older children, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, so let's negate that as well. So having a little snack before bedtime is a really good idea. We're not talking a meal. We don't want that tummy to be absolutely chock-a-block full of food, but just a little snack. And I'm going to say Google it. I don't often tell parents with SEN children to go to Google, but I am this time. So Google sleepy foods and you'll be surprised how many foods are out there. These are foods contain natural chemicals and or hormones that combined with a carbohydrate after about an hour of eating them can help you feel relaxed. So one of the reasons you feel sleepy after a Christmas dinner compared to a main roast dinner is because turkey is full of a chemical called tryptophan, and you combine it with your carbohydrate, which is your roast potato, an hour later you feel sleepy. So we're looking at foods that contain these kind of chemicals. So things like turkey, warm milk, cheese, there is no scientific evidence to show that cheese gives you nightmares. That is a myth. Peanut butter on crackers. There's some, the bananas are brilliant.
Yeah.
A bit of porridge.
I was going to say bananas.
There's loads out there.
They always seem to make me tired.
Yeah. You can also have them for energy because there's loads of natural things in there to boost you, but that's because you're up and you're busy and it kind of has a different effect. But at night time they've got melatonin, they've got potassium, they've got magnesium, and they're actually really, really useful. But on their own this is going to do nothing, but as part of an holistic approach to sleep they can be really useful.
Have you got any top tips for navigating a changing seasons and how that might disrupt our children's sleep?
Yeah, clock changes is a really busy time for parents to call us at the charity. We see a huge spike in our phone calls at that time. What we're asking our children and ourselves to do is to suddenly change our sleep cycles by an hour, and that's really difficult to do. So it's quite simple, really. As the clocks go forward in the spring, we just start bedtime 10 minutes earlier every few nights. So start 10 minutes earlier, give them a few nights to adapt to that. Come back again by 10 minutes, give them a few nights to adapt to that. Just do that really slowly so that by the time the clocks go forward, we have either already adapted to it or we're well on our way to adapting to it, and the last sort of 10-15 minutes isn't going to make much difference. So it's a really slow adaptation, and obviously we do it the opposite way in the autumn when they go backwards, so we then start to go forwards by 10 minutes at a time. So it can be done. It can be done nice and gently. It doesn't have to be the awful night. Some children just do it. They don't care. But some children really struggle.
And going
back to that bedroom environment, this is another reason why in the summer it's so important to make sure that you control that internal light. But one area we forget is that landing. Often we've got light coming in through the front door, which doesn't always have a curtain on it. The landing light very often isn't a blackout curtain, or it's quite, you know, it's quite loose and flimsy. So one of the things I also suggest is parents put like a blackout curtain on the outside of the bedroom door, so that no light from outside in the landing is going to filter into the bedroom light.
So the next question is, how do sensory issues impact a child's ability to sleep well, and how important is sensory regulation in improving sleep quality?
That's a huge question, and I can spend a day training people in this. It's a massive, massive subject. But if a body isn't relaxed or safe in a sensory sense, then it will cause dysregulation. And our brains and our bodies need to be relaxed at the same time so that we can go to sleep. So if one's relaxed and the other isn't, it's not going to work. You're just not going to be able to drop off. You'll be tossing and turning or getting out of bed or causing disruption just because you don't know what's wrong very often. But as I said earlier, if a child's got sensory issues during the day, then these are definitely going to be present mm-hmm. at night too. So go through the senses. You might know your child has sensory needs and you might be absolutely in tune and spot on about mm-hmm. what those are. However, there might be parents who are new to the journey of SEN and don't actually know what sensory needs are. No one's ever discussed it with them yet. They haven't really understood the concept of it. So it's a new area to get to grips with, and it's a big area. So go through the senses and think, okay, are there any sound sensitivities? Do we need to play some white, pink or yellow frequencies, which are environmental noise blockers? So these are children who maybe have to cover their ears or wear ear defenders. If they're highly sensitive to sound, you might find that in the second half of the night, where we're naturally lighter outside the window, there might be cars going past or people walking, pubs kicking out, that sort of thing. So they come through the deep sleep, they're in that lighter phase of sleep. And those environmental sounds are quite likely to wake them up if they're sound sensitive. So playing those white, yellow and pink frequencies are sound blockers. White is the biggest one. That covers the whole auditory spectrum. The others are just slightly less. So some children get on really well with white noise, but you only need it if you need it. So again, it's part of experimentation. Yeah. If they've got trouble switching off, so these are our fizzy brain children, we need that wind down to try and switch it off and lower brainwave activity. But sometimes once your head hits the pillow, your brain wakes up again, doesn't it? And you start to think about things, even if you're trying not to. So listening to a story, either having a story playlist or having one on loop all night, make sure it's a nighttime story, not a fairy tale, because they're quite quite grim sometimes, aren't they? Perhaps nothing like Harry Potter, unless you've known it and it's familiar to you, but something just that keeps that environment the same. So you're playing it all night long, so when they wake up, there's no change in environment, but it gives them something to focus on rather than those thoughts in their head. And that's much easier to drop off when you're focusing on something else rather than something else controlling you. Things like mindfulness, guided meditation, sleep hypnosis, they can all do the same thing. But I don't know what you're like, Molly. I cannot do meditation.
No.
It doesn't work for me. But sleep hypnosis, I love that. I'm gone in 5 minutes.
I've never heard of sleep hypnosis.
Yeah, it's a bit like guided meditation. And body mapping, so squeezing your toes and loosening them, squeezing your calves and loosening them, sort of mapping your body out like that. It's all kind of, it all comes under the same umbrella, but there are so many different types and so many different ways of doing these things that you've got to find the one that suits you. So if someone said to me, meditate at night, I'd just go, well, that's not going to work, is it?
Yeah. And I tried.
Because
I tried with exactly that. I tried with meditation, could not get my head around it. And then it was you actually who suggested brown noise, and we have that on every night now, and I can't sleep without it.
Ah, that's amazing. So brown noise is for relaxation, and for, seeing as we're talking about frequencies, why not? Green noise is good for re-regulation. So it's not going to stop your child having a meltdown, but what it might do is help them calm down a little bit more when they've come out of it. It may even be able to prevent a child going into one by listening to it beforehand. It's never going to stop one. Nothing stops a meltdown, as we know. But green noise is really good for that re-regulation. Yeah. And then you could switch to brown noise once they've re-regulated. Oh. So frequencies are great.
Yeah. And did you say that brown noise replicates the sound of... Is it the car? Is it a car? Something to do with a car?
So that would be super smooth brown noise. So brown noise, all the frequencies have like a crackle to them.
Yeah,
they're a bit staticky, but it's the frequencies that that they're played at that make a difference. But super smooth brown noise has had that crackle taken out, and it sounds like car tires on a road.
Yeah, that's
If your child falls asleep in the car, very often I'll suggest, like, try Super Smooth Brown Noise, and you can put them in the bed and it feels, sounds like they're in the car. But again, you have to keep it going all night long because our sound environment needs to be the same.
Yeah.
But things like if you cook fish or curry or chili when the children have gone to bed and you've got a smell sensitive child, that could dysregulate them. And things like changing your detergent. So, you know, when mine were little, I bought what was cheapest. But actually, if I had a smell sensitive child, just changing the smell of their bedding, again, could cause that dysregulation.
Yeah.
Muck spreading. Horrible time of year if that's where you live. Nothing you can do about it. But that causes us to dysregulate. You know, when you're driving along, you just think, oh, my God, that's horrible. So what's it doing to our children who are majorly smell sensitive? But make sure you air the rooms. Try and keep that detergent consistent. Maybe have one of those scent, those electric scent burners. I'm not going to suggest flame burners because those are a little bit dangerous. But you can get your electric ones, can't you? Use natural scents, though. Don't use the synthetic ones because they can cause all sorts of neurological issues. Thinking about what they're wearing. Remember those touch sensitive needs. So some children like tight pajamas, other children like to wear shorts, some children have to sleep with no bedclothes on. So think about what their clothing needs are in the day and try and replicate that for them at night time. And my ears always prick up when I hear about a child who sleeps on the floor because it reminds me of my son, or has all of their teddies around them. And this might be a child who's got those proprioceptive issues. So when it was my son, we gave him a hard mattress and that was him solved. He didn't need the floor anymore, which was a bit sad because it was quite cute, but much better for him.
Yeah.
But they also might need some blankets rolling up and putting under the sheet so they're lying directly between them. And if they don't want it, they'll rip them out. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. But I've had so many children where parents say, oh, I did it. And they just went, oh, this is so comfy. And it might be the case as well, if they get into bed with you and they lie really tightly next to you, and you might think, oh, they need the sense of being, of touching me or something. But actually, they could be seeking out that proprioception, which is where my body ends and the world begins. So if I can feel my mum, I can feel the end of my world, that and where hers begins. So thinking about what they're seeking out and why they're seeking it is huge for those physical boundaries. And looking at that environment, I've got so many children, again, I went through referrals, are about 3 in a week, where parents said, oh, they have to sleep with the main light on. And they will not have it off. They're petrified. My answer there is always break the light. Mm. Take the bulb out, break, and say it's broken. And then the choice is, well, you can have this small lamp on or nothing.
Right.
That's your choice. And of course, they're going to choose the small lamp. So already we've lowered their light environment. And we keep that low lamp on until they've forgotten that they needed the main lamp. And only when they don't need it anymore can you suddenly fix it again. But if light, like I said, you know, even those LED lights can impact on melatonin production for a light sensitive child. Mm. We need either a pitch black room or the lowest light possible for that optimum sleep level.
Right. Okay, brilliant. And I think that brings us to the end of our podcast. So last question.
Gosh.
I know, but we got through a lot there. So if we'd like to end our podcast with signposting our parents to some resources or support networks that are out there for children, parents of children with SEN who are facing sleep issues, have you got any, Helen?
Always look at your local offer. You might find that there's some sort of sensory groups that you can join. Every authority offers something different. So go to your children's centres and ask what's on offer. Also, people have specialisms within their work, and you might find that they're really enthusiastic about what they do and they've got lots of advice as well. But things like the National Autistic Society, there's lots of resources on there. Sheffield Children's Hospital, just Google Sheffield Children's Hospital sensory and you come up with their sensory page, and they've got lots and lots of really good advice and top tips and things to try on that as well. And also look at our webpage. We've got a fact sheet specifically for children with SEN. And at the end of that, we've got lots of potential resources for you to go to as well.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, Helen. That was a really brilliant episode. Thank you for all the top tips there. And if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast and were wanting to find out some more resources on routines and sleep, simply head to our website witherstackgroup.co.uk/resources. So thanks everyone for listening, and see you again next time.